A guy gives his mother-in-law a cemetery plot for her birthday. The next year, he doesn't get her a birthday present. She says, "Why didn't you get me a birthday present this year?" He says, "You never used the one I got you last year."
All right, Jackie, I can't believe you talk to me crazy every week. And that's right, you can see Jackie the Joke Man's movie at jokeman.com. Jokemanmovie.com.
Jokemanmovie.com.
And it's a documentary about Jackie and being on the Howard Stern Show. And we thank him for the joke every week. And now we have Tommy Chung. He's got a few words.
Hey, man. Welcome to the Big Bad Broadcast, dude.
All right. Thank you, Tommy. And let's start off the show. We got a great show for you today. Welcome to the Big Bad Broadcast. We have a great show for you today. We got Mike Grief here with you all the time. The
dean, how you doing?
The dean of the Clown College. Yeah. And we got a special guest for you today. We got a guy that we have a good friend of mine, and he's an award-winning journalist. He was voted by Hispanic Magazine as the most influential Hispanic in the U.S. It's pretty impressive.
Very cool. I mean, that's pretty cool.
Served as a vice president and general manager for CNN Headline News and the president of CNN Español. He's a magician, a great friend. Let's introduce to Rolando Santos.
Yes.
Hey, guys. Welcome, how Rolando. You doing? Thank you. Thank you. This will be fun. Okay. I can't tell a joke to save my soul, but I'm a great straight man. So I'm sure this is going to be a great hour.
I feel totally underdressed, man. I thought you said he worked for CVS Pharmacy. You said CNN. Oh, man. Geez, I feel really under. If they could see me, they'd go, "What are you doing here with this?" Welcome, Rolando.
Thank you very much.
You're talking about cult mentality. That's all I listen to in my car is CNN. It's the funniest. And I put on my TV, and my kids are like, they get in the car and they go, "Can we just hear some music?" And I go, "No, I want to hear this."
I just spent the week in Florida. I didn't listen to any news at all. And you know what, John? My hands stopped trembling.
Oh, man. So, Rolando, give us a little background. Like, I know you went to Texas A&M, right?
One of those.
I can't talk today. And you're also in the band, too, right?
Yeah. So my background is I was born and raised on the Texas-Mexico border, a little place called Eagle Pass. I graduated from Texas A&M University, was a member of the Fighting Texas Aggie band there. And then my broadcast career actually started at a radio station on the border. Radio station KEPS, KINL, when I was about 16 years old. I started off as a disc jockey, but I really kind of liked the news, and the news director and the general manager kind of saw that and kind of pushed me in that direction. Interestingly for me, English is actually my second language, right? I was born in a Mexican-American family, and we spoke Spanish predominantly and picked up English as we went through, of course.
At what age?
Actually, my parents insisted that I pick up English all the way through, starting at whatever, 5 or 6. But in and around me, family, aunts, uncles, things like that, it was all Spanish, so fully bilingual. But I grew up, interestingly, with a slight Mexican and Texas accent. And I had to get rid of both because back in the day, we're talking the 70s.
What is that like? Que pasa, you all?
That's like trying to give up the New York accent.
Pretty close. That's exactly right. You're from that part of the world where you had to get rid of that accent too. And so I spent hours and hours in front of a tape recorder trying to get rid of both of those. And it was really helpful because one of the things I learned was that words matter and how you say them and the emphasis and all those things. So I made a career out of words, basically.
That's amazing.
Wow. And then that's exactly what we do. We make a career out of twisting words in weird ways to make them mean things they don't mean. And
so how did you end up? You ended up in Chile, right?
Yeah. So when I my first 16 years in television, so I started in radio, went into TV, worked in San Antonio, Salt Lake City, and San Francisco. And then I made the jump to management. And for that, I went into Spanish language, and that was with Telemundo. In fact, my newsroom won the first Emmy ever for a Spanish language newsroom in Los Angeles. I had a staff of 35, and ABC, CBS, and NBC ONOs had a staff of 125.
Wow.
And so during that period,
that is so cool. I've never even had a staff of one.
Yeah.
And we can't control that.
So during that period,
I'm sorry, go ahead.
National newscast. That's all right. National newscast was being broadcast or being produced by CNN. So they made me the executive producer of the Telemundo newscast working at CNN. And then the two companies split off and I ended up staying with CNN. So I launched CNN en Español. I launched a network in Spain. I launched a network in Turkey and I ended up and I ran CNN headline news for a while. And then I launched a network in Chile, and I liked Chile so much that what was a 2-year assignment turned into 10. I eventually became CEO of that particular joint venture, and then I retired. I retired in 2016.
So when you were in Chile, right, were you married and you had kids then?
Yeah, no, yes, we did.
Yeah.
The answer to the no part was they lived in Atlanta because
right.
My daughters, when I left, to go to Chile, were in high school, and the launch of a network in that first year is an all-consuming thing. I mean, it's a 24-hour thing. We didn't have a building. We didn't have anything. And I didn't feel comfortable pulling them out in their end of their sophomore year, into their junior year. They're going to miss proms and all
right.
that good stuff when they weren't really going to see me. And on top of it, I had one daughter in particular, Rosalind, who had a pretty good acting career going at
right.
that point. You know, she did plays and things like that. And we also had, what are we going to do for, you know, university visits when you're, you know, 7,000 miles away? So the way we worked it out, and it worked out because the overnight flight from Chile to Atlanta is about 7.5-8 hours. So I would work in Chile for maybe 2 weeks, come back and work out of CNN for 3 or 4 days, and then just kind of bounce back and forth, right? And because the seasons are reversed, they'd spend winters, the summers there, here, but they would go visit me during the summer, which was winter, so they got to do, you know, skiing and different things like that.
Yeah, the reason why I ask is because I had two kids, and I was working cruise ships, and I had to be gone 2 weeks a month. And you always wonder,
yeah.
how is this going to affect your kids? And my kid, two kids, turned out pretty good. And
yep.
but it's
right.
It's hard. It's, you know, I remember somebody telling me it's harder on you than it is from them because that's a life they know. You know,
I think that that's a very accurate statement. Now, we've talked a lot about this. I was actually closer to my daughter. I have twin daughters.
Right.
And then most parents who were there all the time, because what we would do is back then it was Skype, right, rather than
right.
FaceTime or anything like that. And so every night except Friday and Saturday at 9 o'clock, we would Skype.
Right.
And that was their time. And it was just, and we just got together and there are rules. And the rules were they could tell me anything that they wanted to tell me and I couldn't get mad. Now, there may be consequences if they misbehave, but I wouldn't blow a gasket,
right?
Right.
right.
And
right.
I didn't want that to be the image because you're there for 30 minutes with them and then 24 hours later, they don't see you the next morning where you've already forgiven them and this and the other, right?
right
so I was really
right.
careful about that. And it worked out yeah. really well because, yes, I would listen to them. And it got to the point where they could tell me and did tell me anything and everything, right? And
right.
to this day, they're really comfortable just being really open with me.
That's
so
great.
I think
that's a great
it was
relationship.
Something that we had to work with. Now, interestingly, when they were young, really young, I traveled a lot for CNN because I was launching in networks and businesses around the world for them. And so what I would do when they were really young is I would record bedtime stories on
yeah.
a tape recorder, the old tape recorder, you know, the, and that actually had tape in it. And so every night they would hear me tell them a bedtime story, whether they could
yeah.
get a hold of me or not, because back
wow.
then you really didn't even have Skype back in
right,
that
right.
time, you know?
Yeah. With me,
Rolando, thanks. Thanks for making me feel like a shitty dad, Rolando. Thank you very much.
Hey,
John
hey,
started
I ask,
it.
I want to
John
ask,
started it. What was my fault?
Well,
wait, why don't we bring up one thing here? Really
my
quick.
Internet was going in and out, so I don't know what I missed. I wanted to ask one question that I've always wanted to ask a journalist, and you're the first, you know, actual real, you know, journalist that I've ever talked to, I think. So what does Wolf Blitzer smell like?
Very nice.
I mean, come on, what cologne does he wear? I mean, that guy is like, you know that Wolf Blitzer is picking up women left and right, you know?
Just think of a cleaned up Wolfman Jack.
If you know what cologne you
just think of a cleaned up Wolfman Jack.
So back to the kids thing. When I was really at the thing of traveling so much and felt really like guilty about it and stuff, my daughter's best friend, her father was some VP at NBC. And he would get up in the morning and take the train before she got up to school. He would come home at 8 o'clock at night, take the 8 o'clock train home. So he missed her at night. Saturday, he basically slept all day. And then he got to see her on Sunday. So my daughter felt like she had a better deal, you know? But here, you talk about how kids tell you, I mean, this is a really funny story. So I had this deal with this limo company. So they always took me back from the airport because I was traveling so much. So I pull up and my daughter always wanted to come out and get in the limo and sit in the limo. She was like four. So anyway, I come out, I pull up and she's not there. So I go to my wife, I go, where's Lindsay? And she goes, oh, we had a little problem. She's having a timeout. And I go, what happened? She goes, I was trying to unload the groceries out of the car. And she just stood at the doorway going, ma, 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 while I was talking to the neighbor, ma, ma. And I said, Lindsay, don't be so rude, right? You know, I'm talking to the neighbor. You say, excuse me. Ma, ma. And she goes, so I turn around and she's shaking her butt at me outside the door. She goes, her butt's like 4 inches big. And she's like shaking her butt. So I said, that's it. You're having a timeout. So you need to go talk to her. So I walk up to her and I go, what happened? And she goes, nothing. And I go, don't lie to me. You got to tell me the truth. And she goes, okay. So like mom was talking to the neighbor and I had to ask her something really important. And I kept trying to get her by saying, ma, ma, ma. And then she said to me, if you say that one more time, you're being punished. And I go, what happened? She goes, nothing. And I go, what happened? She goes, I started shaking my butt at her outside the door. And I'm trying not to laugh. And I go, and why would you do that? And she goes, I had to go for the laugh. I come downstairs, right? And my wife goes, so did you talk to her? I go, yeah. And she goes, what did she tell you? And I go, well, she told me she had to go for the laugh. And she goes, what did you tell her? I go, you got to know your audience.
I love it. I love it. So you get, and I love that. And a timeout. This is such a new, I don't know, manure. My fault. Let me tell you, the timeout for me was the time I was unconscious after I annoyed my father. That was timeout. That was it. You know, we live in such a different day and age where it's like you're just pamper and baby. But you know what? You're right. You have a better life. I'm so jealous of my recording night bedtime stories for your kid. I would have never even thought of anything like that. You know, that's
pretty
cool.
But
you didn't travel
a lot back then.
Well, I was divorced from my first wife when my son was 8 months old. So it was we were always pretty much apart. He'd spend the weekends with me.
So. Well, now that you depressed us.
Not him. He's happy. He's like, man, he was grateful that I wasn't around because I didn't tell, you know, night bedtime stories. My bedtime stories were like, okay, so I jumped over the counter at a 7-Eleven today and the guy put up a bit of a fight and then I had to not, you know, so good night, son.
Yeah. So you must have interviewed some pretty interesting people. Or as Larry
I
had a great career. You want to hear about which one? Go ahead.
I want to hear about the Night Stalker. I mean, Richard. I mean, well, that's like one of the most famous.
I covered a lot of very interesting people. I think that people say, who is the one, right? And there are so many of them. Sometimes it's just someone on the street that, you know, does something that's heroic from almost any perspective that you would look at it, and they're thrust into the limelight. And then there are other times. I think one of the most significant interviews actually was the shortest, but it was the one that I'll remember because it was with Mother Teresa, and she had come to San Jose to do some kind of a charity thing, And we were in this big auditorium and it was full of noise, right? And as you would imagine. And so we walk up to her, and every one of us is going to have 3 or 4 minutes with her to ask her basically one question and all the different television stations. And my photographer at the time was a guy named Buster De Bruner. And Buster was an old Navy ensign. In fact, he served on the Enterprise in World War II. I mean, he was just an crusty old guy. He was actually a sweetheart, but he projected this aura of, you know, crustiness.
Like Mike.
And so we walked up. Yeah, kind of like Mike. We walked up, and you hear all this noise, and then you get about 20 or 30 feet from her, and all of a sudden, it's absolutely quiet. And I ask her the questions, and she talks to me, answers the questions, and she says, the last thing she said to me as I started to step away was, continue to do what you do because you're going to make a difference more than you realize. This is long before networks and all this other stuff. I had no idea I was going to go on to launch 4 networks around the world.
That's incredible.
And then as I stepped back, like the room rushed back in, like you see in the movies, right? You got that Star Wars effect or the warp factor effect, right? And I turned around, and my first thought was, wow, I truly was the presence of somebody that was extraordinary, a saint, if you will. And I turned around to say something to Buster, and Buster had tears coming down his eyes. And this guy was an old salt in every sense of the word, right?
Can I ask you, do you remember what's the first question? What would somebody ask Mother Teresa, lead off with asking Mother Teresa? That's
actually because she was there for a very specific event, a fundraising event. I asked her to tell me about the fundraising event.
Okay.
So it was. It had to do with that particular thing.
He's interviewing Mother Teresa, and we're interviewing Tommy Chong.
But you know what? They're both smoking weed. So what's the difference? Come on, you know Mother Teresa's choking up. That's why she's so nice.
Boy, I'm glad we're in 3 different locations, because when you get struck by lightning, I don't want to be near you.
Well, that would have happened years ago if that was going to happen. That is amazing, though. Mother, you know what, John? We are really outclassed here.
Not at all. No, man, you know what? You can't let it go to your head. I was born and raised on the Texas-Mexico border, and one of the things that I'd never lost and that my parents ingrained in me is that I come from there. And you know, here's an interesting thing. I was launching a network in Turkey, and I went to the Hagia Sophia, the mosque that before it was a mosque, it was a Catholic church. And there are these bronze doors.
Where in Turkey?
In Istanbul.
Oh, I've been there.
And these bronze doors date to something like 300 AD, right? So whoever put these doors together, and they're still used, I mean, we're still there, right? It's the most amazing. And I sat there.
I love a carpenter.
The first thing I thought was, man, you are a long way from the Rio Grande. And then the second thought was, truly the sense of how insignificant you are in the scheme of things when it's all said and done.
That's so cool. You know, John, here's the difference. John, you're talking about you've been there. He's talking about he launched a network there.
I know. I was there, unfortunately. I mean, fortunately, but it was really weird. I was there during Ramadan. And it's a very not a good year. You know, I mean, you're walking down the street and then over the loudspeakers, the daily prayers just start, and they just drop where they are with their little rugs, and they just kneel down.
Yeah.
And, you know, you don't kneel down, and you're walking around, they're looking at you like, how disrespectful. And you're like, well, I got to get to where I'm going. I'm not, you know, it was really uncomfortable, you know, I mean, to say the least. So, but the people were really nice when I was there, you know. Was that the Blue Mosque?
Yes. Well, the Blue Mosque is across from the Hagia Sophia.
So was Mother Teresa your first really big, important interview, or just the one that left the biggest impression on you?
I think it left the biggest impression on me because of this star Trek warp effect that happened. And I really did walk away thinking I really was in the presence of someone that, of all the famous people that I've ever met, she was in a totally different category. I was born and raised a Catholic, so I have that kind of a background. I'm thinking to myself, wow, I am in the presence of a saint. And then to see Buster behind me, I mean, Buster didn't take any crap from anybody. I mean, anywhere, anytime, he would. I mean, think about this. He served on the Enterprise in World War II, for God's sake.
Well, there's certain things that'll hit a guy right in the heart.
Absolutely. Yeah. And so those two things left lasting impressions. Yeah.
You know what you want? It's going to sound ridiculous, but I'm not even joking. I had that overwhelming kind of aura feeling when I met Stevie Wonder once. And I mean, I've met a lot of celebrities and things and done a lot of TV shows. But just standing next to him, it was like he gave off this just higher thing. You know, it's hard to explain, but he radiated just cool, whatever it was, you know, had that special, that something.
Yeah. I mean, there are all kinds of people who do that. That's true. Yeah. I think she's probably the most powerful.
Probably. I would suppose the Pope has that kind. My wife actually met and her mother met the Pope John Paul years ago. Her first husband worked on the movie The Godfather, so they got to hang out with Francis Ford Coppola, met the Pope. It was pretty cool, but I'm guessing the Pope gives off that kind of an aura.
Yeah, I would imagine.
I would suppose, yeah.
I was at the Vatican once, and they were starting to hear confession. And my wife at the time goes, "You're Catholic. You should go to confession at the Vatican. What better souvenir do you have?" Yeah. I was like, "I don't know, you know."
So you go down. I'm just going to sin again tomorrow.
Yeah. I'm going to tell the Pope how many times I've masturbated. All right, there we go.
So you go down there, and there's five or six different confessionals, all in different languages. You know, they have what language they are. So I go into the one that says English. And it's like the confessional is, it looks like a giant piece of carved oak. It's, you know, I mean, it's, you know that this thing is as old as Christ. I mean, it's amazing. And you walk in and there's no curtain between you and the priest, right? It's here. You are face to face. And this is what he says. He goes, "All right, so I just have a couple of questions." He goes, "Do you cheat on your taxes?" I was like, "What?
Nope."
And then he's like, and then he goes, and I swear to God, this is a true story. He goes, "Have you ever murdered anybody?" And
how
I'm
would
thinking,
I know?
And I'm thinking, well, this is Italy, I guess. But it was,
have
wild.
I ever murdered anybody?
It
not
was
in Italy.
Wild. It was
not
wild.
In Italy.
It was like an interrogation. It wasn't like, "Bless me, Father, I have sinned. This is what happened." This was like an interrogation. And wow. Boy, I walked out of there like, wow, this is weird. This is really weird.
It's a good thing he didn't ask you your relationship with that goat. Anyway.
Oh, I thought you said ghost. What? So tell us like the dark side of who you've interviewed. So we've gone from the white. Now we got to go to the dark.
Yeah.
There was a guy named Joseph Paul Franklin who shot and killed several people. He absolutely hated me. This was when I was working in Salt Lake City. He, among others, shot two kids. Now think about this. He shot two kids at about 300 yards who were jogging in a park at 11 o'clock at night with a rifle with an open sight.
Jeez.
Okay. And he absolutely hated African Americans. Just hated blacks.
So it was all just a racial thing.
Absolutely. And there were two black kids. And, you know, I did story after story on this guy, like everyone else did in Salt Lake. And when he was finally caught, he was caught in Miami and brought back. And so he's on trial. And at one point there's a recess in the trial. And as I walk by, he looks at me and he goes that, "You're living proof. Mexicans like you are living proof that Indians used to screw buffalo." And he said, if I ever get out of here, you're dead.
Wow.
So I go back and I'm filing my report because they're in this break, and I get a call from the sheriff's department. And they say, "Where are you?" I said, "Well, I'm back at the station." He goes, "Good, we want you to stay there." And I'm like, "What the hell?" It turns son of a bitch escaped.
Oh my God.
Right? Wow. And so I have to stay, literally, they say, don't go any near any windows, no open doors, nothing. You need to basically stay in the center of the building.
Wow, he shot somebody at 500 yards. Yeah, you'd be in danger. Jesus.
Right, 300 yards, right. Wow. So anyway, the bottom line is he wound up going up an elevator shaft, and it took him 4 or 5 hours to figure out which shaft and where he was. But this guy was badass. And the one that I think, I'm going to change subjects on you, he eventually went to prison and was, not surprisingly, knifed to death by I don't know if it was one of the different prison gangs who were not white.
Right.
It's pretty bad the when one you're that in I thought, and it's pretty bad when you're in prison and the prisoners think you're the scum of the earth.
Yeah.
Oh, there were groups. There were groups in there. I'm sure Rolando knows all about that, but that, you know, there are certain people, child molesters, you know, right, whatever, because even prisoners all have kids, and, you know, you don't want to go.
The one that I thought was absolutely evil epitomized was Richard Ramirez, the Night Stalker.
Yeah.
I mean, when you looked at this guy, there was nothing, no social redeeming value in his eyes. He looked at you, and to him, he was looking at you trying to figure out how am I going to kill him?
Hmm.
How am I going to make this person's last moments on earth absolutely miserable?
Did you get any answer, any kind of, I mean, was it a rational, not that you can have a rational conversation like with a guy like that.
No,
but
I didn't do an interview with him. I covered him and his crime spree. He eventually was caught in Southern California, but he did a couple of crimes up in San Francisco.
He was caught. He was caught by bystanders that recognized him and grabbed him and held him for beat the hell out of him and held him for the cops. He was so dangerous, and you know, people just, they put his picture out there, and knew everyone was on the lookout for him.
Yeah, well, that's the one of all the different murderers and serial killers and people that I've seen, he's the one that in my head had absolutely no social. Yeah. I mean, he was truly a sociopath.
Remember,
I was going to say, even Manson, you know what I mean? When you'd see interviews with him, you could tell like half of it was an act. I mean, I think he was so institutionalized.
You're 100% right. Manson was not a killer. You know what Manson was? A master manipulator. He truly was. He was not.
It's so funny that Mike and I were both on the same page, because I was going to say the same thing. When you watch those Tom Snyder interviews with Manson, he was so crazy, but so manipulative. It almost made sense.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? Like when he's going, well, I don't live in your world. I was brought up in the prison world. So what I do isn't necessarily wrong. You know what I mean? Where it's like you go, yeah, he's got a point. You know what I mean? You got to keep bringing. Well, you got it. But I mean, it's true. That's how he got these people to believe
It makes you wonder, a guy like that was a musician. Now, if he would have been successful with his music, would he still have turned into a murderer? It's just, you know, that would have been an insane kind of a thing. You'd have a famous singer who's also a mass murderer. Let's write that down. That's a script.
Well, you know, basically, it's a different form of manipulation when you stop and think about it. He's just manipulating your emotions, whether you're a writer or a songwriter or whatever. He just took it to the dark side. But when people ask me about that particular question, I don't think that he was a killer in the true sense of like Richard Ramirez, for example, or other serial killers. I think that he just was he could look at you, instantly define you, and then figure out what buttons to push to get you to do what he wanted you to do.
Right. We know politicians that are just like that.
Without a doubt.
He who shall not be named. There's the bell.
But every time we go off on a tangent, this is the Trump bell to bring us back to reality.
Now I understand.
So just out of curiosity, so I mean, so Richard Ramirez, definitely the most evil. Any other, not that, I mean, I've seen lots of shows about serial, I don't know why. To me, it's an interesting topic. I mean, I'm just curious, anyone else, known or unknown, it doesn't matter, but that you thought was really evil, like as if serial killers aren't all evil, but probably
Ted Bundy. Wow. I didn't cross paths with him directly. I inadvertently crossed paths with one of the people that got away from him. He was a law student at the University of Utah. And one of his classmates, one evening, they were late, or some kind of study class or something or other. And so he asked her, "Hey, do you want to ride home?" Right. And she just got this vibe and just didn't go. And right. that instinct probably saved her, she says, looking back
probably,
on it.
Probably the axe sitting in his back seat, you know.
So, well, a little Volkswagen, you know, that he had at the time. So I think that
he was the clown, probably, right? Up there.
No, Gacy was the clown.
Gacy.
No, John Bundy was, or Ted yeah, Bundy was the...
He was like a lawyer. He could have been a lawyer, that guy.
Absolutely. He was a good-looking, handsome, the kind of guy that you would absolutely not in a million years suspect.
He would fake an injury like his arm, and so he would ask like women at the park or beach or somewhere and say, "Hey, can you give me a hand with this?" So he'd get them back to the car, and then he would grab them, throw them in his little Volkswagen or whatever, and then, rape and kill them. He was just... But I remember the judge at his trial told him, said, "Man, you could have been a lawyer, you know," and that's probably, I think that's what he was studying. He said, you went the wrong way.
It's law.
You know? Yeah.
So did you ever have to go into like war zones and get shot at and stuff?
Like
been
New
shot
York?
At, right? I've been shot at.
I've been shot at 3 or 4 times. I think more urban
had nothing
war
to do
zones.
With war, but you know.
No, actually, it's right. Actually, right. Urban war zones, I think more than anything else. The first time I was shot at was about a year out of college. I was in San Antonio, my first job, and it was 1979, and it was the San Antonio is this big week long festival called Fiesta. Big deal, really big deal.
Beautiful.
And a guy named Ira Atterbury opened fire on the crowd. It was kind of interesting for me because I was off. I was standing next to a police officer watching the parade like everybody else. And I heard all the traffic on the two-way. So we're only about 4 blocks from the TV station. So I went and I grabbed a microwave van. Now, back then, we're talking, late 70s, you didn't have, you couldn't push a button and the thing went up. You had to get up there and put this huge dish up and all this other stuff. So I parked myself, managed to get in across. He's on a corner, a four-way, right? You have two streets that intersect, Broadway, and I forget the other street that it was. But anyway, it intersects. So he was on this corner and I parked catty corner to him diagonally across the street, right? And I'm setting up this van and I have to get up there physically to push the dish up. And it was one of those times where I know that I have a guardian angel.
Mother Teresa.
I've tried their patience to no end, right? My family has a nickname for me that only my family uses. So I'm up there. And in the middle of all the, there's fire, there's shots are going back and forth, people are screaming. And very clearly, there's this one moment where I hear a male voice say, "Rolly, stop." Mm-hmm. And I keep in mind, I'm on top of basically a van. There's no way, no how. That one fraction of a second where I hesitated, I actually felt a whoosh in front of my face. Whoa. And the window shattered. Wow. On this side of me.
Oh,
so in essence, that split second was the difference between this and this.
Wow.
Literally in the temple.
Wow.
And so that was like one of the first times that I've been shot at. And
because normally when you get shot at, it's like
time.
An ex-wife or an ex-girlfriend for me.
Yeah, right.
Man, you've had some incredible life, man.
It's been more than once you've been shot at?
Yeah, you said three times.
So it was about a few months later. This guy barricaded himself inside a house and was shooting. He'd shot a police officer. And everybody went to the front of the house. You talk about intuition and all this stuff, right? Everybody went to this side of the street. And I told my photographer, you know what? Everyone's over there. Let's go around this side. So we went around this back kind of alley thing. And before they blocked it off, before the police were, and we came to the back of the house, right? So the situation is we're in the back of the house. We're hiding behind this car, not knowing what's going to happen. We're just there. And then there are police behind me, sheriff's deputies and police behind us, right? So he comes out and he has 44 magnums in his hand and he shoots here, takes these two officers down, shoots this way towards us. And then now people are shooting back over us, right? And neither my photographer or I ducked. It was just, you know, when you're in that moment.
Right. Got to get the shot.
First of all, you're bulletproof and you're young and, you know, you're just bulletproof. So anyway, they wind up shooting him, right? And so I looked down and then my photographer and I crouched down, a guy named Roy Barra. And then Roy and I start looking at one another and our eyes meet. And I realize both of us are checking each other out to see if we're hurt, right?
Right.
And then we just started, the adrenaline kicked in and we started laughing and could not stop laughing.
Yeah.
Just the adrenaline, right? The epilogue to the story is, so my mother is driving between my hometown and one of the other towns that she did business with. And she's listening to Bud Little on the radio. Bud Little is a very famous broadcaster here in San Antonio. And Bud is talking about Rolando Santos and his photographer are in front of me. I can see them. They're between us and the gunman. So my mother is getting a rolling.
Oh, man.
Right?
Yeah.
And there's no cell phones in those days or anything else. Okay. I mean, she is listening to this. And then he says, oh my God, they've both gone down. Well, we went down. We ducked, right?
Right.
It was all over at that point.
Right.
So for about this. And then he says, no, they're okay. They just ducked behind the car. But mother says,
between
the time he said they went down, and then he says, no, they're okay. If you listen to the broadcast, there's like a 2-second gap there, right?
Yeah.
Mom said it felt like it
like
was
20
an
minutes.
Hour.
Yeah, no
yeah,
kidding.
I was like,
I'd
my
like
God,
to hear
the longest 2 seconds of her life.
I'd like to hear that broadcast because, like you said, you guys are laughing. So the broadcast was probably like this: the gunman is down, and you guys are laughing your asses off. Which
it was,
you know,
yeah, that's,
but
that's
yeah, I'm
just
sure
adrenaline kicking.
I'm sure. No, I've had that, but I'm sure your mother, you know, lived a lifetime in those few seconds. I can only imagine.
Oh yeah, it's got to be horrible.
Yeah.
Did you ever have to interview any gang members, you know, like biker gangs or anything?
There's no such thing, John. It's like the mafia. There's no such thing. What are you talking about?
let's say that I interviewed motorcycle club members and we'll leave it at that.
Okay.
So I don't get in trouble and I don't necessarily want one club to be upset because I interviewed the other
That's
club.
It. Yeah.
So the short answer is I lived in San Francisco, so you can deduce from there what the clubs were. And the answer would be yes.
Wow.
Wow.
All right. So we need to keep Rolando alive. So we're going to switch gears to him being a magician.
I was just going to bring that up. I was just going to say, so what, this incredible, this awesome,
I've
this kind unbelievable
of,
career.
I've died on the vine quite a few times being a magician. I don't know about that.
I'm just curious what brings you from like that life of adrenaline and just unbelievable, just to magic. I mean, just have you always, did something you always loved or?
Here's the deal. I got into broadcasting to make a difference. True story. So I was 16 years old working at the radio station. And during the summer at KPS, during the summer, the news director would take off 4 weeks and I would become the news director, which was great experience for later in my career, right? And during one of those years, there was a woman, an 83-year-old woman named Crescencia Campos, who a guy knocked on her door, wanted some water. You know, it's 112 degrees out in San Antonio, I mean, in Eagle Pass on the border. She, of course, says yes. She turns around, goes to get the water. He takes a hammer and then beats her over the head with it and kills her, right? And I am incensed. I am
this
just
is great
I'm
comedy stuff, Rolando.
I am furious. Well, you asked the questions, pal. I'm furious because she's got no family. She doesn't have anyone to defend her. And this was years before America's Most Wanted. I did story after story after story on this guy, and they finally got him, right? And I was there for a sentencing.
Good for you.
And when he got sentenced, I walked out of there and I knew that I had made a difference in someone's life because no one could speak for her. And then that was the moment. Mom wanted a lawyer. Mother wanted a doctor. In fact, my first semester was a biology major, pre-med. Ha, what a joke that was. and that was my calling. And so it was making a difference that way.
Right.
I'm leading into the magic because there's a kind of a step here. So I got into broadcasting to make a difference, okay, or in journalism. So when I went from on air to management, I lost the part about being on air, writing stories every day, et cetera. And I missed that. And I had a friend of mine who had a connection to the Magic Castle. And I went to see the magic, to see the great Tom Zoni, Johnny Thompson and his wife. And then gotten bit by the bug and I started studying that. And so flash forward a little bit, I didn't perform so much. I went to Spain to launch a network and I'm having dinner. Great place. It's a cave that has amazing steaks and stuff. And behind me is an elderly woman with her three daughters, adult daughters. And she drops her cane. So I pick up the cane and I give it to her. Now, I'm reading this book in Spanish and I've got a deck of cards. Never performed before. And she says, "Do you do magic?" And I said, "No." And she was kind of insistent, kind of looked like my grandmother. And you don't say no to your grandmother. It just doesn't work that way. So I did three tricks and they all worked. And I was just happy as a clam because not only did I perform, you got to think what's going on. I'm going from English into Spanish. And then there's Spain Spanish, which is not like Mexican Spanish. And it all worked. So I finished my meal and I'm walking out. One of the daughters comes over and says, "Thank you." And I said, "Oh, no, don't worry about it. I had a great time. I've never performed. It worked out really well." She goes, "No, you don't understand. My mother is dying. This is her favorite restaurant. And now I can remember her laughing and having a good time." And that was the moment where I went from, I'm not going to do magic tricks. I want to do magic for people because I know it can make a difference. So I took this, I can make a difference as a journalist. And then it just became, I can make a difference doing that with magic.
That's in comedy. It's kind of like that. I mean, it's not where I started, but because I always felt I had a gift. But when you know, after you come off a real successful set or something like that, and I can't even count how many times people said, "Wow, you know, I just needed that." Because you know how, you know, you never know what somebody's going through. You know, you don't know why they end up at a comedy club or whatever. But I've had it so many times where people have said, you know, "Yeah, somebody in the family just passed," or "Something just happened," and they go, "You don't know how bad I needed to laugh. Thank you." You know, and so, yes, I get that. I totally get that.
That's what Trump said to me. I'm serious.
I get that.
What? No, after Trump, come on, he grabbed your ass, though, first, right? Trump,
I got swindled into working at Mar-a-Lago and did a show. And at the end of the show, Trump came up to me and he hugged me.
Ring the bell on yourself, John.
I know. Trump came up to me and he hugged me and he went, "Man, I so needed that." You know, and people people are going, "Do you feel any different?" He goes, "Thank you." He kept going, "Thank you." And people go, "Well, did you feel any different about him after that?" I go, "No, he's just polite in that job." You know?
you know the funny thing, John? I know comedians. And I know quite a few that are conservative, and it would be like the greatest thing in their life to get to perform for him.
I know.
And yet they can't get in there. And you're a liberal and whatever, and you got against your
will. I know.
You did a show against your will. So it's like,
I was totally tricked into it. And it's funny as that, because the other president I performed for was George Bush Sr. And you know, it's just like,
there you go.
You know, I mean, that was kind of cool. During my show, Barbara Bush gave me a thumbs up, which was like a home run, which was kind of, she was a cool lady. So anyway,
the most important person I ever did a set for was the warden. Anyway, but we were talking about magic. So how long have you been doing out there doing the magic?
Well, he's also very involved in the International Brotherhood of Magicians.
Right, and also into the seance and the spirit stuff also, right, if I'm not mistaken.
Yep, a little bit of the Ferentino vibe there. So I'm a past president of the International Brotherhood of Magicians, member of the Magic Circle in London, Magic Castle in Los Angeles, and I guess boy, it's been a while now. 25, 26, 20. Wow. Yeah, almost 30 years now.
So you're no amateur with the magic either. So you've got two major career. I mean, with the McCastle and the brother. I mean, that's. I really feel bad about myself now, John.
And he's also a phenomenal lecturer.
Bill. Oh, thanks. I appreciate that. Well, you know what? When I do lecturing, I talk about things that are important to me, and that I, you know, making a difference, and how to connect with people, and that's really, you know, what I've done my whole career. Whether it's magic or whether it's journalism, it's about finding the connections with people.
My hat's off to you, because I mean, it's like there's not many people who see what they like, know what they want, and go after it, and it seems to have a lot of integrity, and you just went and you've been very successful with it. So I mean, congratulations on that. That's, to me, that's amazing.
Well, I appreciate that. I like to think that I saw the things in people that I liked and tried to emulate those things. And then I saw the things in people that I don't like, and I tried not to do those things. I haven't always been successful, but you know what? At least you give it a shot, you know?
Yeah, no, absolutely.
And I will add a little personal note here. He's a great friend. And anytime I'm working on anything, I'll just send it to him. Or he was at my house looking at my new vampire stuff, and he gave me some amazing suggestions, which, by the way, I changed that to kilograms. he read this thing, and it's supposed to take place in London. I had a coroner report, and he goes, it's only one thing. And I go, what? He goes, you have the guy's weight in pounds. It should be in kilograms. So I changed it to kilograms. And I just want you to know that personally, every piece of advice you give me, I cherish. And I really do. And, you know, I think our listeners will find this interesting. You know, the part when you talk about in your lecture about writing, how you write a story? Can you tell? Yeah. I mean, I think people would find that really interesting.
Right. So I think that, first of all, words matter, right? And we all of us have what I call universal emotions. If I were to tell you, hey, there's a cancer cure in Denmark, would you be interested? And I ask you to raise your hand, and I've asked this question literally all over the world, in all kinds of languages, everyone raises their hand. That's a universal, right? If I ask you, you're pissed off because taxes are going up, yes, food costs, etc. Or if I say something like, don't you just hate it when you get up in the middle of the night, you got to go to the bathroom, and you put your feet down on the floor, and there's this little breeze on your ankles, and for a second you think someone's going to pull you under the bed? I always ask that question, and it's my favorite question, because you find out who's honest and who's not. There'll be a bunch of people who put their arms over, right? And then there are others who don't but want to, and you can tell. And then I say, those of you that didn't are lying. Because 90% of the people in the world, regardless of culture, background, religion, have that nightmare. That's sure. A universal nightmare. In fact, there's a Doctor Who episode that's dedicated with Peter Capaldi, I think, if I remember right, dedicated, I think it's called The Silence, dedicated to that one theme. So my point is that there are universal emotions, and if you tap into them, then you make a connection. And sure. This is the way marketing world works. It's been this way forever, right? And the emotions are happiness, sadness, fear, awe, anger, right? And if you tap into those things, you're going to make a connection with somebody. And the way you do that is the way you present the information. So if I were to tell you, for example, there was a fire in San Antonio at an apartment complex and two people died, that would create a reaction for you. Right. But if I were to say, you know what, 5-year-old John and his teddy bear don't have a place to stay tonight. There was a fire at his apartment complex. Two people died. 200 are homeless. Which are you going to remember?
Yeah.
And there's yet a third way. And this is the most impactful. And this creates what a very famous magician and mentor of mine named Eugene Berger called a shared personal reality. And that's this. If I tell you, flames roared through an apartment complex here in San Antonio. Two people died. 200 are homeless. The flames were so intense, that they melted the aluminum chairs in the community room.
Wow.
That is a shared personal reality, because everybody that's listening or everybody in the room will have a different vision of what those flames look like. And they're all going to have a different vision of what those melted aluminum chairs are. So now it really feels like I'm talking to you, because I'm now using your memories, your imagination to complete the story. So in essence, what I do is I throw the line out and I let you fill in the blank, and that creates a shared personal reality. And when you're, as a comedian, you understand, instead of carrying the load, the moment you can hit a nerve with the audience, you should need to follow that down, because they'll carry the load, the energy for you. Otherwise, you're pushing uphill all the time.
That's the secret of a corporate gig. You know, find out as much as you can about the boss and make fun of the boss or something like that. I apologize. My internet connection seems to be messing around, but I'm...
We got you back. You know, in the lecture, this will be the last thing, because I think we're almost out of time. You talk about how you develop that, you know, how I think people find that interesting, like how you're walking down the street and you see something.
Ah, you want to do know how to do a live shot, like, oh, okay.
Right.
So the latest lecture that I do combines all these elements with an element that nobody ever teaches, and that is how to do a live shot like a journalist. So this is how a live shot works, the way you practice it. First of all, you retain more information in your mind than you ever realize. And so the secret to being able to tell a story later is to remember these bits and pieces. And so the way you do to train yourself, and how I trained journalists for decades, and I learned it this way too, it's not written in a book, it's kind of oral history, right? You go down the street when you're driving or some other place that you're sitting, but not your home, because everything is familiar in your home. And if you're walking or driving down the street and you're at a stop sign, you look and you recite 20 seconds worth of what you see. So let's say you're at 5th and Main. There's a woman pushing a baby carriage across the crosswalk. Okay. Then you go to the next stoplight and you say, okay, now I need to add 20 more seconds to what I saw behind me. So now it's a woman at 5th and Main, crossing the crosswalk, pushing a baby carriage, but you know what? She's wearing a yellow slicker, but it's not raining. How odd. Then you go to the next stoplight, and now you add another 20 seconds. So you have basically a minute of context. So now the woman is at 5th and Main, crossing a crosswalk, wearing a slicker on a day that's sunny. And oh, you know what? It's not a baby carriage. She's actually pushing the little dog inside what looks like a baby carriage. So why are you doing this? What you're doing is you're taking these elements that later will help you create a story. Right. And the best example I can give you is something that happened to me. I gave this lecture at the Magic Circle in London. And afterwards, I was in a pub. I was walking down a street and I saw this pub, and it had like a wall full of scotch, and I'm a scotch drinker, right? So I get in there and I'm going like, wow, I've never seen these before. So the bartender's a young lady, and so I asked for a drink, and I'm writing, you know, she brings me the scotch, I'm going through my scotch, and she's got other customers, and I'm writing down the things that I've learned and the feedback from the lecturers and this and the other. And she comes up to me and says, do you want another? And I said, yes. She goes, do you do magic? And I said, yeah. And she goes, do you do Darren Brown kind of shit? And I kind of laughed and said, yeah, I can do that kind of stuff. And she said, will you do something for me? I said, sure. So now remember, I've walked into a pub, don't know her from Adam. I don't have anything on me. I mean, there's no prep of any kind, right? So she comes back with two bottles of scotch. One is the next bottle she wants me to try. And then one is what she says, this is the best scotch we have. It's the most expensive. If you do something for me that blows my mind, I'm going to give you this scotch for free. And not the whole bottle, but she's going to, you know, the drink.
Right.
So I look at her and I say, okay, may I touch your forehead, please? And so I touch her temples. And so I touch her temples and I say, wow, that's kind of unusual. Normally I get these floods of images from people when I do that, and I have to kind of sort through the images, but yours kind of behind a nice fog, a nice, I don't know, it's kind of a wall, but it's not an impenetrable wall. It's happened a lot here in England. the times that it's happened before, it's usually because the person is either a druid or perhaps Wiccan. But in your case, it feels like it's kind of both. And I see these symbols of both those religions, and they kind of meshed together, and her eyes got really big, right? She goes, oh my God, how did you know that? My mother is Wiccan, my father is a druid,
right? Right.
And then I said, and you know, the other thing I don't understand is I keep seeing this image of a three, maybe it's a two, it's a three, and a heart, but I haven't picked any cards or anything. And no, actually it's it's two hearts intertwined with a red three in the middle. Does that mean anything? She absolutely lost her shit.
Wow.
Right.
What did it mean? Well, you don't know. She didn't tell you.
No. She had a twin sister.
Uh-huh.
And that was their symbol. And the three in the Druid tradition has a lot of meaning. And so now I'm not going to reveal how I did that because this is a public podcast. But let me tell you, I didn't pay for another drink the whole rest of the night. And the scotch was really good.
Well, here's what I want to know. So the memory point is,
finish. Yeah. So that will make its way into a story, and that's what makes texture in a story. Those little tidbits, instead of just facts, the fact that happened, and I describe the bar, and the bar is all beat up, and there's dust on some of the bottles, etc. Then that creates the ambience that we're talking about.
That's pretty cool. What I was going to say is all of this, so the memory thing. So you're walking down the street and you see this, that. And I'm going to try to remember and utilize this because I think that would also work in an alibi.
Yes, that's very true. That would definitely work in that. So by the way, going back to that particular point, after about 3 weeks, if you do that every day, your memory will improve just as a memory exercise, right? But as a magician, one of the biggest fears that a magician has is when they go off script, they don't exactly know where to go or what to say. And most people have this. What am I going to say? Well, now you have things to say. You know that you can stall for a minute if you need to, right?
Right, right.
Or a minute and a half, just because you've absorbed more information than you realize when you walk into a room. That's all.
Well, that's what Eugene Berger used to say. You have to have a script, because once you have a script, you can play you can around deviate. The script, and you can always come back to it.
Well, also, for a comedian or a magician, and I think a good thing too is you walk in, and like I would never like the audience. I didn't like them to see me until I went up, because I go on as a character, you know. So, but I would listen, and you overhear people say things, and that also gives you ammunition you can talk about that'll blow somebody's mind. You know, if you point at somebody and you go, yeah, whatever, you know, that information. So it really is. Listening and just, you know, is a great thing to implement into.
But listen, once again, we're out of time.
All right. Wow. This went by really fast.
Yeah, it went really fast. So let's thank Rolando Santos for being here.
Yes. Yes. Thank you so much, Rolando.
Thanks, guys.
And bringing up
our standards. I mean, geez. Wow.
Yeah.
What do we got next week? We got Frank, the guy who cleans the toilets at John's 7-Eleven.
We have a good show next week. We have these three college kids that invented an app that's really interesting. It's really interesting. Wow. Like, you know, when I was in college, inventing an app was the furthest thing from my mind. So
there was no such, John, there was no such thing as an app. You were learning about the Roman Empire, and it was first day, you know, it was actually going on while you were learning it. So
I didn't even know what an app was. All right, so I'm gonna say goodbye right now, and if you guys want to stick around for a minute. So goodbye, everybody. We'll see you next week.
Yes. The podcast playground. All right.